angle. Let me give you a little bit of a background. When I call it the month of Geula, it was a month of Geula until it wasn't, and now it is. What does that mean? So this month used to be a very happy month. This was the month that we were liberated from Mitzrayim. This is the month that we marched towards Har Sinai. This is the month that we counted down the Sfira, and in our imagination, it's a sad and miserable countdown where we relive Jewish tragedy. It wasn't always that way. Sfiras HaOmer, in fact, according to some Rishonim, they actually counted in the Midbar, before there was even a mitzvah. So here you are before Har Sinai, they were counting down to Har Sinai. The count isn't a product of the mitzvah. The mitzvah may be a product of their own self-initiated counting. Okay, Kodesh Baruch Hu has other reasons in mind, but as a transition to Eretz Yisrael, there was a countdown from Pesach to Shavuot. So remember, making a national pilgrimage twice in 2 months is a big thing. It's a big thing, getting together in Yerushalayim, getting together with your family, being at the Kotel, which isn't the Kotel, because it's just a building, it's just a wall on the outer rim. It's not the Kotel. You walk into the Ezras Nashim, the Ezras Kvarim, you walk into the Beis HaMikdash. So it's a really big deal. And it was a season of gratitude where, remember, under supernatural conditions, you always have a successful harvest. It's not like you have to worry about your finances. It's not like, will the stock market do well or not? See, we live in a world in which Hashem's presence is darkened. Could you imagine if every single market is a bull market? Every single market, your stocks keep going up. As long as you keep Torah mitzvahs, it's in Shema. So in a world of cause and effect, it's pretty comfortable. You do a mitzvah, and you're assured of a Kodesh Baruch Hu's reciprocal compensation. And you cash in. This is the time you cash in your ships. It's like going to Vegas and winning at the blackjack table. Not that I was ever at Vegas. And then coming over to the ships. And now you're at the window and you're getting your money. So this is cashing in your ships from all the hard work and all the amunah. So it's a very, very happy time. And just to punctuate how happy the season was, Purim unfolds during the season. Purim doesn't happen on Purim. Purim happens on Pesach. So the big drama of the turnaround and the parties and the fasting and will he stick out the scepter, will he not stick out the scepter, that happens on Pesach. Keep in mind, that year, they fasted on Pesach. When Lech Kenosis, Kal Yehudim, and Simu Alai, it was Pesach. They tossed their matzah in the garbage. Pretty easy on the women that year to cook and clean because they never Seder that year because everyone was fasting anyway. No Seder this year. And then over those months, remember, it took a while for everything to land because there was a quick turnaround. But Achashverosh still hadn't authorized and they had to beg him again to go back into the palace. When does it happen? Does anyone know when the letters were written that the Jews can defend themselves? I know this is going back in time a little, but when? The 23rd of Sivan. This is a pretty auspicious month for good things to be happening to the Jewish people. This is well before anyone knew that Adar would be a great month. For us, Mishenichas Adar Marbim Mesimcha, but that year it hadn't yet been Marbim Mesimcha. When it occurred a couple months later, then it was Marv Mesimcha. But Mishenichnas Nisan, Marv Mesimcha, for forever. Until history changed twice. And Svira is a minhag. That's why my minhag is, based on the Lichtenstein, not saying you have to, but just so you should understand and put into context, my minhag is, I shave every Friday. What do I shave every Friday during Svira? I don't shave every Friday during the 3 weeks. Because the 3 weeks is Avelis. It's a minhag, but it's a minhag that amplified halacha. The Gemara in Yevamos speaks about Avelis for the Beis HaMikdash. So the concept of being a halachic Avel for the Beis HaMikdash exists in Gemara. Obviously, the Gemara didn't say 3 weeks. And so these are all clusters around the core, which is halacha. Svira has no basis in halacha. Now, it doesn't make it insignificant. It makes it very significant. Right? I remember a couple months ago, someone asked me to speak to a young man who was thinking about how halacha evolves. And he had found some Rebbe that he was very attached to who had claimed that, let's go back to the original pre-minhagim, authentic halacha, and see what the Yishalmi says about the way we should. And in the Yishalmi, for example, we were tefillin even at mincha. In the Yishalmi, we don't, because this is before the minhagim of Ashkenaz in France corrupted Judaism. So I talked to him about, he was a very, very sincere boy. He wasn't trying to be a skeptical, wasn't trying to be in any way subversive. So I talked to him, I said, imagine halacha as a three-legged table. One leg of the table is halacha. And halacha, you want to go back to the original source, or one table is the original text, you want to find the original text and what it said. Another leg of the table is minhag. What does the minhag say? How has minhag reshaped our imagination? Okay, so again, I keep referencing back, not that I don't feel like I'm raising this just to be controversial, just to be a sensationalist, but the issue of, let's say, tefillin for women. Right? And so in the 13th century, before the Shulchan Aruch is written, there's a plethora of sources. Again, most of the sources, most women don't wear tefillin because they weren't involved in Jewish ritual life, but if a sincere woman wears tefillin, it resonates differently, I'm not saying yes or no, than it does in a post-Shulchan Aruch world, where Am Yisrael has accepted the Shulchan Aruch has a consensus, and that consensus is a bit. Now, if a woman comes and says, it's absolutely crucial for me to wear tefillin in private, even though, so you can find out that there's plenty of ways to find the Torah. I'm just saying the dynamic shift, because halacha is a dynamic process. Halacha is a process that unfolds over time. And sometimes you have to learn the pace of halacha. And the third leg of the table is in minhag, but masara. So he had a very interesting, had a hard time understanding masara, as most people do. A lot of times you hear, why can't we make this change? It's not against halacha. There's no minhagim to the contrary. What do you mean, this slippery little ambiguity called masara? I've got a real need, and you're hitting me with this vague, incoherent, nebulous term called masara. No, masara is the glue, and it sticks and holds our family. So the kid asked me, give me an example of masara. So I said, I'll tell you what. Does your mother make good chicken soup? Says yes. Does it smell good, Erev Shabbos? Yeah, that's masara. And trust me, you'll remember the chicken soup a lot stronger than you remember the Dvar Torah that your father or your sister gave at the Shabbos table, because smell and aroma sticks. He said, give me another example. I said, there was a Pew study. You know what Pew studies are? Americans know. Pew study is this multi-religious organization. A pew in English is a bench. Safsal B'Toch HaKnesia is a seat in a shul or pew, P-E-U. So there's a foundation called the Pew Foundation, and they conduct polls about the state of religion in the general society. So they conducted a survey and a study, and they found that families that sing Zemiros together on Shabbos, the kids tend to stay religious. And families where they don't sing Zemiros together have a higher rate of defection. Who would have thought? There's no mitzvah to sing Zemiros. What do you mean? Just look up the Rambam. Read a Rambam. Lacha Mishnah. Kiddush. There's something beyond just how halachic you are and how black your tefillin are that gets conveyed. Think a lot about how you convey to the next generation. What do you give to the next generation? Okay, you don't just give. For you, you can find a Kodesh Baruch Hu in many ways, but what makes it transferable? What makes it movable when you have succession? Like, I think one of the interesting parts of this yeshiva is that the Rosh Yeshiva left an intellectual bank, a bank of ideas, intellectual legacy. So some people like myself, I try to articulate it for you. Others, they articulate it themselves. I don't think Rav Meidan spends so much time quoting Rav Aharon Rav Amital, but his Torah has been deeply, deeply shaped by their Torah, and that's something that's transferable, and it can move over. Experiences are less transferable. So if you had a great experience, you might, let's just say, this, I'm not saying this in a critical way, say you went to a Hasidic yeshiva, you had a great experience, but it's very hard to transfer experiences, which is why sometimes it's harder. Okay, that's why a lot of Hasidus is based on codes and dress and cultural symbols, because that is easily transferable, because it's tangible, something you can pass over. So, a lot of halacha, and I think I probably shared this with you in the past, I apologize if I'm repeating, but you're going to be right at the front lines of those questions. So it's not always whether the change is correct or incorrect or necessary or not necessary. There's something called pace. Everything in life is pace. Everything in life is timing. Balance is a product of two variables. Okay, write this equation down. Okay? Balance, you want balance, is degree and pace. You want to be balanced in your decision making. If you know how much, a lot of people know the how much part, but the pace is a little harder. Especially when you're young, because you're impatient and you want things to happen quickly. When you get older, you see more time. So the more time you see, the more you see pace and how quickly things should move, how slowly things should move. I think one of the legacies, let's say, of McDonald's is when we I remember walking to the small little caravan when the place started, was down the hill there, right by the Tzomet, right by those old, and we had like two rooms. There were no flags being waved, no loud announcements. It was not like we were going to change the world of Torah. Let's just start learning. Let's just do it with very quiet facts on the ground. Some people have loud noise, a lot of noise all the time around them. There's always headlines. So we'll just do things in a very quiet way, but it's the quiet march of progress that makes those changes. It's not just women's issues. We're facing, I mean, hopefully I'll face them also, but you'll face them in a way that's much more integral than I am. Artificial intelligence is going to change the world. And it's going to change self-perception. It's going to change identity. It's going to change religious identity. I think laboratory food is going to be a game changer. What's going to happen? We no longer have to worry about feeding the planet. We can create food and water on our own. What does it say about Hashem? Does that depend on Hashem? I know myself. I used to say Tfilas Tal, or Tfilas Geshem, with a lot of Kavanah. Because I knew that over the next year, if there's no rainfall, then our country would suffer terrible, terrible water shortages. I remember one of the hardest things in my life was I loved when I came to Israel being my gardener. I built this beautiful garden. I used to mow the lawn, nothing like fresh cut grass and the smell and Erev Shabbos, and I cut roses from Ireland, like storybook. And then water just got too expensive and had to kill the garden. It was a very hard part of living in Eretz Yisrael. If I lived in New York, I wouldn't have had that, but that's part of living in Eretz Yisrael. We didn't have enough rainfall. To be perfectly honest, when I daven Geshem today, the drama has been taken away. There's still drama, right? Shem can intervene. But basically, we've created water. We've created the ability to take ocean water and to sweeten it and to provide water, hopefully, for the whole world. So I have a whole different view of Geshem. It's like I don't pay attention during Geshem, but it's a different experience because davening has to be honest. You can't parrot davening from 1622. This is not going to work in 2022. It has to be 2023 type of davening. So a lot of it is like when you change. It's like this great story. I must have told you this story. I was on the plane a long, long time ago next to a chassid. Okay, so we're sitting there talking. Very nice man, very intelligent person. He asked me to explain the internet to him. He had never been exposed to the internet. Like, he'd heard of it, he'd seen it, but he didn't know. And I think, just listening to his innocence, he honestly believed there was a little person in the computer running around giving answers. So I tried to explain to him, having a degree in computer science, and so maybe went a little too far. I got a little too much into the wiring and the circuitry, but not what he asked for. But I explained it to him, and then after having the conversation, he said, do you realize that in 20 years, you won't be able to pay your bank account, you won't be able to pay your bill, you won't be able to get information without the internet? And I was trying to ask what I thought was a provocative question. And he basically said to me, I don't know if he said it, but that was my takeaway. He said, yeah, but at least we would have bought 20 years of safety and security. So here's a good line. I thought I was talking to a caveman. In the end, I was a guinea pig. Namely, sometimes it pays to stay on the sidelines a little bit and wait things out and see where it goes, see where the technology lands, see what's happening. It's very, very delicate because on the other hand, technology is an all-or-nothing proposition. Someone once said that with technology, you're either on the steamroller or you're part of the road. Like, there's no middle ground. You're either part of it or you get steamrolled by it. Remember, like 15, 20 years ago, I was invited to participate in a panel of rabbis discussing Facebook. Like, you'd think the devil himself had come from hell to snatch souls. Like, Facebook this and Facebook that. And I always like speaking last, which means I never get... I don't realize there have been in panels when you speak last, that means you don't speak at all because your time is used and everyone goes over time. You know, the goal is, oh, there are 15 people there. We have an hour. Everyone speak 4 minutes. Yeah, good luck getting 15 rabbis to speak 4 minutes. 5 minutes, 6 minutes. So I always get like, I have 20 seconds. Oh, Rabbi Tiger, we didn't hear from you yet. Okay, for 20 seconds. So what I mean is I always have to have these one lines. I think like one line in 15 seconds to bring down the house. Rav Amital knew how to do that. Rav Amital was always last. Everyone took his time. One lalik. It happened to me dozens of times. Because I always like to go last. I don't mind not talking. I'm happy. I'm happy being quiet. So I was the last person to speak. And at 20 seconds, I said, you know, you can debate all you want the value and the dangers of social media. But let me just tell you, you're all now social media celebrities. Oh, my. What do we do? I said, well, when this conversation began, I took a picture. And I put it on my Facebook book. When Facebook was popular. Now, you know how many likes you've got over the last hour and people have seen this conversation? And my point was, you can't control it. Technology is hard to control. But the point he was making, maybe it's counterintuitive. Maybe he says, maybe you can't control it. Maybe you can create a world. Maybe we have to stay on the sidelines for a little bit. I don't know, but pace is so important. In relationships, pace is important. In what's right at the following time, what's right at your age, what's right at different ages, in your marriage, when you're beginning married, what's appropriate when you're a young married couple, what's appropriate pace and context and degree. It's not just about ramming ideas into the public sector, but in knowing when, what it's going to replace. And anyway, so whatever we got to, I don't know what we're talking about. So it used to be a very, very, very happy month. And then two things happen to turn into sad monks, and that's what Sfira, right? So I was getting to Minhag, right? So Sfira is a Minhag without any halachic anchor. It's just a Minhag. It's an important Minhag, and you should keep Sfira, but Rav Lichtenstein believed, and you could argue the point, and I'm perfectly comfortable arguing, you know, disagreeing with the point, that the Minhag of Sfira that has no halachic foundation should not override Kavod Shabbos that has not just foundation in halacha, but actually comes from pseudo-biblical sources. It's called the Divrei Kabbalah because it's based on a pasuk in Yeshaya. Now, Rav Aaron was the first person to think of this? Yeah. Why? Because he was the smartest person to ever live? No. Because 100 years ago, before Jewish males shaved, because you weren't allowed to shave, because shaving was usher, because you only had razors, before Norelco came out with electric shavers, why do you think every single Jew in history had a beard? because it was usher to shave. So if you don't shave a couple weeks on Svira, it's not going to really kill your Shabbos because your beard will look a little more fully grown, a little more like a forest than it normally looks. Because you got a long beard, so you go a couple weeks without shaving, it's a little longer. No one's going to know the difference. But if clean-shaven 21st century me doesn't shave for Shabbos, I look like this. And you can say, well, that's the way Jews look during Svira, which is fine. That's perfectly fine. But you can also make the argument that, as you can during Chol HaMoed, that because we've shifted into a shaving world, we don't have the liberty to not shave during Svira based on a minhag and ruin Shabbos, which has a lot more halachic weight than Svira. And others will say, no, that's our Masara, that's our minhag. I'm perfectly comfortable with both of them. And again, I am in not the minority, I am in the minority of the minority of the minority. When I spoke in England a couple of years ago, so I like picking on England, and I spoke, people were aghast. Where's your beard? You must be a conservative rabbi. Okay, it's Svira. Everyone walks around with a beard. I didn't give it to them. I just said, you know what? I think I'm keeping halacha as piously as I can. In my worldview, you're not keeping, again, I'm not in an antagonistic way, but I'm trying to keep Kavod Shabbos. You know, it's not you're less firm. People feel that a kula makes you less firm. No, if you're being mekil to eat someone's food at their house, you're being machmir and Kavod Abrios. I'm not saying whether you should or you shouldn't, but taking the food and saying, you're not firm enough for me, and this food is treif, and take your meat and throw it in the garbage, may not be the firm thing to do. You just have to sometimes reconfigure the spectrum. Sometimes it sounds like, oh, I'm not being firm. No, Rav Aaron is very helpful teaching us to reconfigure the spectrum. It's not like you love this less, you love this more. Right? So, for example, just something I was talking about with a boy this week, when Rav Lichtenstein talked to us about the difference between emuna versus bitachon. This is going to be, we haven't even started this year. Okay, what's the difference between emuna and bitachon? Emuna is theological. Bitachon is pragmatic. People confuse the terms. Emuna means I believe that Hashem created the world, supervises the world, and responds to human decisions with reward and punishment. It's conceptual, theological, background beliefs, foundational beliefs. Bitachon is I'm facing my brother Esav. Should I rely on Hashem saving me? Or should I make human effort to try to avoid his wrath and his anger and triumph? Bitachon is how I should respond to a particular situation. Should I have bitachon or not? And you could be the biggest maimin in the world. But for all sorts of reasons, maybe I have too many chatoim, maybe Hashem already paid me back, maybe in some chanalanes, maybe there are a host of reasons that even though I have emuna from here to wazoo, I shouldn't have bitachon in Hashem. It's all right. It's now listen to the following punchline. It may be more from to have less bitachon. It may be less from to have more bitachon. Not in your words, in your terminology. It's always more firm to have more emuna. But Hashem may not want you to have bitachon at the expense of human effort in this context because it's relying on an ace, because it's foolhardy, because it's capricious, because you're not assessing yourself properly. You think you're greater than you are. You're gambling on Hashem. So therefore, in the, let's say, the political discourse of Eretz Yisrael, yeah, we shouldn't rely on diplomatic issues and international pressure, and we're here in Eretz Yisrael, and we should take policies that may seem to be, to others, irresponsible, internationally dangerous, because we have bitachon, and that makes us more firm. And you are more pragmatic, you have less bitachon. Yeah, that may be make me more firm, because Hashem may want me to operate. I'm not saying what you should or you shouldn't, I'm just giving you a test case, a hypothetical. What's sort of looking for? What's the word in English? Hamsaga. What's a hamsaga? You got it ready. Conceptualization. You take something and you put it into concept. So sometimes you have to question the variables that determine the spectrum of religiosity. You'd be more firm, not less firm. And it's a whole different way of viewing things. Again, you have to be sincere in your firm kite. Anyways, having discussed Minhag and Masara and all that stuff, let's get back to this period. Two events happened during Svira, each of which were iconic and historical and larger than life. And a lot of people don't know that they're two. A lot of people don't know their role in history and how they changed history. So I'm here to tell you what they are so that you'll appreciate Svira more. One happened at the beginning of Golus. One happened right at what I call the halftime of Golus. If you're a sports fan, halftime means halfway through. Okay? What happened? See, everyone always knew that there was a potential, terrible, horrific, hideous Golus. Just read Parshas Kisavo. Kisavo is that you'll go off your land, you'll lose your sovereignty, and Kisavo is Holocaust. You'll be crazy by what you see, you'll be shrouded by darkness, in the morning you won't know whether you'll live out the day, and now you want to live out the morning. It's just horrific. When I go to my Danik, I read those psukim prayer. You can't imagine it. Now, the thing is, you don't know if it's going to happen because there are alternate historical narratives that are put on the shelf, and our behavior determines which narrative gets implemented, like different computer programs. So had we not betrayed Hashem in the first Beis HaMikdash, you know what? Kisavo never would have happened. Kisavo was an option. We would have lived our lives in Eretz Yisrael. No, we wouldn't have a Benos Chutz La'aretz program in Migdal HaOz because everyone would be Israeli. We'd all have lived in Israel for the last thousands of years in utopia and serenity, showcasing HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence through our nation, as we're trying to do now. But no Spain, no France, no Tinek, no Russia, nothing. So you don't know if it's going to happen. And more importantly, even if you know it is going to happen, the question is, when is it going to happen? Because Galus is not like someone gets up and says, Galus is beginning now. It's not like Hashem makes an announcement. It's happening now. It happens in increments, happens in installments. We didn't lose all of our sovereignty at once. We still lived in Eretz Yisrael. Who knows? Maybe Galus Bavel part two, 70 years and back. It's just, why do you think the Bar Kokhba rebellion happened? Said, look at me, everyone. 70 years after the destruction of Beis HaMikdash, because they're working on the number 70. Okay, 60. 70 AD, Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, 132. So 62 years. Oh, what were they thinking? Oh, we've got this great person, Rabbi Akiva thinks he's Mashiach, we have some pretty good victories. It's just like Galus Bavel, 70 years and back. So no one really knows. You're looking for these events that will tell you, oh, yeah, right? How do I know? People ask, how do I know this is redemptive? So the answer is you don't. It's not something rational. But there's something called the Holocaust, and you know, it's not just another pogrom. It's not just another blood libel. It's not just another crusade. It was a Holocaust. And the Holocaust means history shifted. And it's a different world, and it's a different era, and I, you know, something else is happening. I can't tell you what. I can't give you A to B to C to D, but I can tell you that something else is happening in our world. There are these massive, massive events that shift history, and then see what time it is, and gives you the sense that things are changing. So what was that massive event that taught Am Yisrael that this is happening, this Galus is happening? It was really two things. One of them was the terrible, terrible massacre of these great rabbis. It was ruthless, tearing out people's tongues, putting Sifrei Torah around them and burning them alive, cutting off their heads. And Rishmael's head was cut off and his skin was pulled off because he had such nice skin. Remember, those days, nice skin means you didn't have like blood coming out of it, nice skin. When the nice skin we see today, their hygiene was horrible. So nice skin means, you know, the worst skin today would be three times better than whoever had nice skin that's like a supernaturally nice skin. So the daughter of the Caesar was so enamored with the Bishmal skin, she said, please preserve the skin. So they took the skin off and they embalmed it around a sheitel head. That's the best way I can say it. They did a sheitel head, they put the skin on the sheitel head, and every tish above, they would parade the sheitel head around the Colosseum to show everyone that Yaakov had, but not the sheitel, that Yaakov had destroyed Esav. And it was terrible, it was horrible. Akiva had his bones crushed by hammers. Just, why are you doing this to us? Rome had zero interest in torture. They had complete interest in subjugation. They weren't barbarians. They tried to defend against barbarians. They ultimately lost in Visigoth, but they tried to defend against it. So what would they do? They'd come into a city, rape, plunder, murder, 10%, and then tell the people in the city or in the country, now you're ours. Live your life, worship your gods, keep your culture. We need two things. We need coins and soldiers. That's how you build an empire. If you wipe out people, you can't have an empire. If you want an empire and you believe you're spreading the light of a new civilization, then you subjugate, you don't terrorize. That's not the goal. You terrorize just to subjugate, but once you suppress, all of a sudden they're going after these rabbanim with just such ruthless, brutal. But we know that because there are faces and names, and we can actually name them. By the way, it happened in two waves. One wave in 70, one wave in 130. It wasn't like they got all of them in a room. We read them as one kina and one pia of the Yom Kippur, everyone standing in a room and getting killed. It was waves. It happened over 70, 80 years. But more traumatic to the people who lived through it than that, again, we're not going to have a kin about it because they're faceless, but more traumatic than 10 rabbis being mutilated is 24,000 students dying out of nowhere. If you're living during that period, you're saying, what's the big trauma? It's not seeing your Rabbanim being killed. It's seeing 24,000 people dying in 3 months, as we just lived through. Now, why did they die? Was it a pandemic? Was it they were fighting Bar Kokhba rebellion and they were killed in battle? Either way, you don't have 24,000 people die. We have inflated death figures because we live in a nuclear era and we can kill people in a flash. And they didn't have 24. It takes a lot of time to kill 24,000 people on the battlefield if you're going hand-to-hand battle by sword. So just however they died, these were figures that didn't compute. And this was the sign that Galus was beginning. This was the sign. These two events, and it occurred during this period, and all of a sudden, this period that had been so joyous, so triumphant, so meaningful, had now shifted into trauma and tragedy. Now, here's what a lot of people don't follow. The first part of Galus wasn't so bad. Wasn't so terrible. Where did we live? Iran, Iraq. These are now notorious places, but they're pretty friendly to us. Remember, it took a while for these religions that ultimately tortured us to get momentum. Remember, Islam only emerges in the 6th century, so they're not on the map for the first half of the Gulf, and it takes them a while. And Christianity, until they get their act together, you know, they only conquer, Rome only adopts Christianity in the 4th century, so it's not like everyone's a Christian and everyone's a Muslim, and let's get the Jews. A lot of paganists, a lot of idol worshippers, a lot of Vikings, everyone's doing their own thing, and the Jews doing their own thing. We don't have that much persecution. Again, you have your average garden variety persecutions, and it's more wars, by the way. Jews suffer more based on the wars that Persia fights against other empires, and the Babylonian loses its prestige, and the Romans invade, and the Jews, of course, are defenseless. They don't really have a state or an army, so they're always going to be in the bottom of the food chain, but it's not as if let's go get the Jews. You know, they're people, they live pretty smart, pretty intelligent, they're literate, they give, they take. No, it's not like there's a Jewish issue. All of a sudden, Christianity institutionalizes anti-Semitism. You don't have that in 800, institutionalized anti-Semitism. Yeah, people hate the outsider, hate the Jews, or the outsider also. And the birth of institutionalized Christian anti-Semitism is 1096. What's the bellwether event? What happened in 1096? No. 1096, that's 13th, 14th century. 1096, anyone got to know? Second period, don't know? Come on. Oh, gosh. Got to talk to Esty. Got to give a class in Jewish history. More important than listening to another way to read Parshas Mishpatim. Okay, Jewish history. First Crusades. End of the 11th century. And these crusaders are drunk mercs who just come back from the battlefield and they're raping women in France. The Pope has to have something to do with these drunk guys, so send them off to Jerusalem and kill some Muslims. And they are completely gullible to being riled up against the Jews. And this age-old myth that had been couched already in the 1st and 2nd century, but no one really went for it until it became popularized. In the 11th century, Jews killed Jesus, and we're reenacting that killing by taking little babies and drinking their blood for matzah. Every Easter, we're reenacting the killing, and it's a story. And there's not one crusade, there's 5 crusades. And that first crusade essentially obliterates the Jews of Rhineland. What are the 3 cities in Rhineland that the crusades marched through in the spring of 1096 during Sphira? That we read 3 kinnos about on Tisha B'Av. Anyone know the names of the 3 Rhineland cities? Worms. Magens. Magensa, Vermisa, and Spires, Ashpira. Hebrew, the acronym is Shom. Shin, Vav, Men. Mem. Ashpira, Shin, Vermisa, Vav, Mem, Magensa. You'll see that in rabbinic literature and Svarim. It happens during these 3 months. And that's the second milestone on Galus, like a mile marker. Now, Galus is going to get ugly. Not just going to be living in Babylonia and Persia with, it's going to be pogroms, it's going to be expulsions, it's going to be discriminations, it's going to be killings, it's going to be hatred, it's going to be violence, it's going to be, and it's going to end with the worst. It's going to end with the biggest nightmare of them all, the Holocaust. So these events are not just, oh, let's keep Sphira because 2 bad things happened. These are two gullus makers. They make gullus. One sends us into the long gullus, and one ratchets up the brutality of the gullus where it hadn't been that nightmarish. And that, just 1 second. And that's, and this season becomes a season that had once been happy and joyous. Now becomes a season of tragedy and suffering, but not just episodic. Oh, there are two episodes that happen. It's iconic. It's characteristic. It's historic. This is the period that Gullus was started, or at least people absorb these events that convey that Gullus was starting, and the events of this period launched Christian anti-Semitism, institutional anti-Semitism, which turned Gullus dark and ugly. So this became the period of Gullus. Now I'll answer your question, but hold on, because you know what? Calendars are dynamic. We're rewriting the calendar. Yes?
How was it that the beginning of the Gullus was more or less okay when we still have like the United States, where there was going to be this enormous like erasing of the Jewish...
Right, so we're dealing with different periods. Megillat Esther is 500 B.C., I'm talking about the first 1,000 years from, let's say, 0 to 1,000.
Okay.
It's different. That was not really... That was the first Gullus, Gullus Bavel. That was really easy, and it became even easier after the Nes Purim, because we didn't really suffer. There was no bloodshed. No one died. But I'm talking about 700 years later, right? 500 B.C. It's like 586 B.C. is Purim. Talking about the first 1,000 years, of, you know, between 0 or 70 and 1,000. Okay? Okay, so now, of course, we're back in our country and we're rewriting Chodesh Iyar. This is the period between Pesach and Shavuos, and Hashem is giving us Nisan. Nothing is coincidental. Language is coincidence. This is a period that we had the courage to get up and build our country. It took a lot of courage in 1948. It was saying, no, don't do it. The Arabs are invading. No one's supporting you. We don't have any American support. And Ben-Gurion decided, no, we're going to have our country. We're going to declare it this period. And then far more, and I'll talk about this in Mir Tashem next week, because next week is the last time we meet before Yom Yerushalayim. Yom Yerushalayim is on a Thursday, so I'll give you a little bit more focus on Yom Yerushalayim next week. What happened in 1967? Far, far, far surpassed anything in 48. It's just totally, total apocalypse, total overhaul of history. So we'll talk a little bit about the Six-Day War and Mohammed Shesh Shetayim in 1967, Mir Tashem next week, but it's not a coincidence it happened 3 weeks apart. It's not a coincidence it happened in Chodesh. It's not going to happen in Svir. It's not going to happen in Pesach and Shavuos. So the Jewish calendar is flexible. It is impacted by Jewish history. During our glory period, it's a period of joy and triumph. During our dark period, it became the bellwether month to determine and to showcase what was happening. Now that we're rebuilding and reconstituting our peoplehood, all of a sudden this month is shifting as well. So these months are under construction, under constant construction. And that's why, as an introduction, 40-minute introduction, that's why I want to spend time discussing the events of Gula with you. Okay. I'll tell you what. Let's skip over number 2. We'll get back to it next week in Ritz Hashem. Let's talk about part 3 and forward, okay? Remember last week, whoever was here, we talked a little bit about the redemption from Egypt and how atypical it was and unusual it was. And undeserving, and the Jews were paganists, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu challenged them to respond with some bold initiative, and they refused, and Hashem wanted to destroy them, and Hashem said, I'm going to redeem you, not because you deserve it, but because you represent me, and if I annihilate you, then my presence in this world is retracted and contracted, and that's the Chilul Hashem. And I talked to you about how the Holocaust was the Chilul Hashem, and who knows, again, part of living through Geula is breaking and shattering simplistic. So many people who are engaged in our world, think about it simplistically. Be intellectually honest. We deserve to be redeemed in 1948. Like, what was so special about our people in 1948? What was so special about our generation? Well, we were better than the Samsof, or we were better. The simplistic Zionist propaganda, that, you know, everything before 1948 was terrible and horrible. And the new Jew, there's nothing about the people that lived through 1948 that made them more deserving than previous generations. So obviously there's a selection process taking place, and that creates responsibilities, not just Yom Ha'atzmaut Mongols. What are the responsibilities? What are the duties? But part of it was the proximity to the Holocaust. There's this raging Chilul Hashem. The presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is dwindling in the world. There has to be some reconstitution of Hashem's presence. So we are the beneficiaries of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's larger cosmic divine narrative. There's so many layers to it, but just, you know, if there's one thing, I was telling the boys last night, if there's one thing I would wish on every student that leaves our yeshiva, is to have intellectual honesty, because that is the greatest tool to internalize information and knowledge. Because if you just buy into propaganda without questioning it, without thinking about it. Not because you want to subvert it. A lot of people want to sabotage. Oh, I'm a critical thinker. Critical thinking is very dangerous. You want to be reverential. You want to accept things. But to accept them and live them deeply, they have to make sense to you. They can only make sense to you if you say, well, does it make sense with what I believe? And then when it doesn't, the response is, oh, therefore I'm going to reject it. The response is, okay, how can I make sense of it? I believe there's something here, but I don't yet know how it jives with my own internal clock, my own internal intelligence. Let me work harder. Let me... You know how hard I work sometimes on a chiddush? You know how hard I work on a sugya? You know how hard I work on an article that I work 5 days on it. I think about it maybe 6 or 7 rounds because I'm struggling. I'm not satisfied with mediocre truth. I'm not satisfied. And not because the sugya doesn't make sense. I have yet to uncover the part of the sugya that sits in my heart as truth. And that is the only truth that I can, because I love the sugya so much, because I love the truth so much. And some people use intellectual honesty as a sledgehammer to break anything they can't understand, because when intellectual honesty is coupled with intellectual arrogance, then it's not really intellectual honesty. It's a mask for intellectual being intellectually arrogant because you think you're the sole arbiter of truth. But intellectual honesty is not a sledgehammer to break. It is a tool for internalization, because this is my interface. And for me to internalize, that's to go through me, or else it's not going to settle deeply. That's called authenticity. Intellectual authenticity. And when it's coupled with sincerity and humility and desire to internalize it, that's a very powerful way to study Hashem's Torah. So you're not just parroting cliches, you're trying to integrate into your blood. But it'll only get into your blood if you digest it. And the only way you can digest it is by asking and forcing the truth that hits you out of that idea or out of that text. It's so important. A lot of people in this world don't have intellectual honesty, and you lose intellectual honesty when you become ideologically fervent. Ideology, sometimes a lot of Israelis suffer this, because Israelis become ideological earlier than non-Israelis. So non-Israelis, when they're 15-year-old, they don't really care about anything meaningful. And they only care about things meaningful when they're 18, 19. But their minds are already supple enough and sophisticated enough to see shades of gray, to see nuance. Israeli kids become very ideological at the age of 12, which is great. Problem is, at the age of 12, your mind is still black and white and binary. So you become flag wavers, and you never stop being flag wavers, and then you color reality. It's like shooting an arrow, then drawing the target. And I hear so much claptrap, so much ridiculous, just because people are speaking. I told you last week, I forget who I spoke to what about, right? Let's say we have a conversation about whether people should serve in the army. You talking about this last week? No. Whether Yacharedim should serve in the army, okay? If you're being intellectually, okay, don't get me wrong. I teach at Hasda Yeshiva. My kids go to the army. So don't suspect me of being anti, but I want to be very honest with you. 95% of the Makaros say that people that study Torah have an exemption from serving the army. So the conversation begins with the fact that people that learn Torah should not serve in the army. Now we can have the conversation. I'm happy to have it. I'm happy to give you the reasons why I think people should. But it's just so dishonest, because you believe in the Kool-Aid that you're all drinking, that you've been taught for all these years, that's the only way. Wake up. You're not the only smart person in this world. You're not the only person with the Masara. There are many Masaras. It's your Masara. And there are texts and great people to support it. But don't fall into this ideological trap where it's embarrassing to see. It's embarrassing to see people who are self-fashioned themselves intellectual, and they're so intellectually dishonest because they're so self-absorbed in their own ideology without realizing, let's separate the two. This is what I believe. This is where I get to my conclusion. Where does it start? These are where the sources start. Intellectual honesty. It's one of the most underrated traits, not just in being an academician, but in being a firm person. To be firm has to be authentic. To be authentic has to go through you. To go through you has to go through you. Not just parody. So what were we talking about? Someone help me out here. I know what we're talking about. Okay, so we're talking about Severe, no, that was a long one. No. Cool. That doesn't count. That doesn't count. Rav Amital, right?
Nor the
Rambam. Okay, source number three. Without anything, I gave you a quick summary of source one. I got sidetracked. Okay. Source number three. Previous snapshot of Geula. This is the Geula of Hanukkah. Okay? Since you referenced it before, Hanukkah was about 200 years after Purim. So again, closer. So, the Rambam doesn't mention the Shemen. He mentions it in the second halacha. Remember, the Rambam has to give us the storyline of Hanukkah because it isn't in Tanakh. Megillah says it's in Tanakh.
something really weird happened between the Nes of Purim and the Nes of Hanukkah. Tanakh closed. So that's a fascinating time. The first 200 years of the second Beis HaMikdash, where you segue from Tanakh into Torah Shabbat. By the way, I'm not plugging this. I don't ever plug anything that I give, but if you're interested, during Sfira, I'm giving a day-by-day chronology of how Torah evolved. So I started with Torah before the universe. Tonight I'm talking about Rashi, so we've gotten some good momentum. But I've been going through how was Torah taught in the desert, how was it taught in the days of Sanhedrin, how was it taught in the days of the first Beis HaMikdash, as well as some other views. So it's on my WhatsApp list, and I sent it out a couple of days ago. If anyone wants to sign up, just what's the Masar of Torah? How was it studied? Who is Rashi? How did he change? What were the paradigms he shifted? Talk about tomorrow, as I said, Rabbi Natam tomorrow, at some point the Rambam. What are the Ramchen? Next week I'll talk about Kabbalah and Chassidus because it's new, it's like Boma. Anyway, so this is the second Beis HaMikdash, and the Rambam has to tell us what happened because we don't have it enough. So it says, B'bayi Sheini, Surah 73, Kishagazu, Xeris al Yisrael, Batlu Datam, they challenged us religiously. Remember, this was the first real fight. It's no big deal to bully the little kid in class, right? What happens when you face the big bullying class? That's when you got to be worth your weight. Okay, I remember in second grade. Okay, this was before we had cell phones, before we had video games. So what do we waste our time doing all day? Baseball cards. We had baseball cards and we'd flip. And I decided that I was going to be the best baseball card flipper. So I locked myself in a room for 7 hours until I perfected a wrist movement to flip baseball cards. Second grade, I already had big ambitions to be the king of the baseball card flippers. I don't think I've ever told this story. I've told a lot of stories to ever tell this story. Baseball card flipping. Came in the next day. Let's just say, hot knife through butter. I just obliterated the whole class. Came home with a wad of baseball cards because I was a flipping champion. It didn't really count because these were pushovers. Until day two, I went to the bathroom. That was where the baseball card flipping action took place. And that was where Tzvi hung out. I'm not going to say his last name because he may be listening. And I said, Tzvi, I challenge you to a 20-card, whatever, flip contest. Demolished him. That's when I became the king of the baseball cards.
You must have been really great when bottle flipping was a thing.
Right. It just didn't count. It was embarrassing. I used to come home with like wads and wads and wads of baseball. I didn't know what to do with it. I gave it out. It was baseball cards. It was like it's like burning money. It's just, but beating pushovers is not the same as beating the big guys, the big guns. So until Hanukkah, it didn't count because we were facing off against backward, voodoo, blood-sucking, flesh-eating, crazy savages. And the fact that we defeated those cultures didn't register. You know when it mattered? When we faced off against Greece. That was like facing off against Svi in the bathroom. Because Greece...
Same exact thing.
Greece had civilization. They had culture. So get her an oxygen mask.
Flipping all, like card flipping also?
Yeah. No, he was the mafioso.
He was the what?
Mafioso. He controlled the entire baseball card network.
Oh, okay.
He lent out baseball cards. You had to go to him to get baseball cards. He was, let's say he was good until he met me. And then after that, he became all right. But it wasn't. Like he could flip a card and get 19 of them to land on the same, land on the front of that. I was 20 for 20. It was just like a machine. Someone took them. I still am angry at some of my brothers.
You think you still have the same?
Right?
Do you think you still have?
I don't know. It's been a long time. It's been a long, long time. But it was, put it this way, in my day, it was pretty significant. For a second grader to come up with that movement, it was original. It's very original. No one could see if you could simulate it and copy it, it wouldn't work. Because then they do it. But it was like they couldn't get it. People just didn't get because most of them held it this way and this way. I threw it out, and no one could copy it, because that's the genius. If they can't copy you, then you've got a self-sustaining patent. So.
Copyright.
Oh, copy yeah, it. I know
that. Right. Anyway, girls, back to the conversation. So Hanukkah is the first time that we face off against a worthy opponent, because Greece wasn't savage, barbaric, bloodsuckers. They had
culture, they had democracy, they had science, they had philosophy, they had elevated the human condition beyond the barbaric past. This is a really important cultural moment. Okay, it's not Hanukkah because we don't have time to talk about it. Now, there is a simplistic little stereotype that Purim was this, as you said before, what's your name?
Raya.
Right, you said before, this genocidal threat, which it was. Hanukkah, yeah, it's like a cultural debate. You know, I was asked to, somehow the Christians got hold of me. It's like I'm always doing podcasts for Christians in Texas or something. So they would do a podcast for them on the Aseret HaDibros for Shavuos or something because they have this big debate in Texas now. Can you display the Ten Commandments in public? So some pastor was trying to convince them that they can, wants me to come on as a guest. So like, you know, that guest appearance by a rabbi and a Greek Orthodox pastor, and they discussed religion and philosophy, and Socrates got up, and no, it was violent. It was discriminatory. It was, listen to the Rambam, source number 3, part 2, Upashtu yadam bimamonam uvivnoseyam. They stole our money. They took our women. It wasn't as clean and neat and tidy as our imaginations tend to fabricate because we want to offset it from Purim. Well, Purim was the genocide, right? But now, all of a sudden, it's clean and neat. No, it was pretty ugly. Hashem saved them. Hatzilam. This is Rav Amital's go-to Rambam. So this is not just me. All this is Rav Amital's voice, but this was like his favorite Rambam. He would quote this early and often. Now, when you think about that great redemption during Hanukkah, what happened after Hanukkah? The 200 years between Hanukkah and the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, let's say Hanukkah happens roughly. Remember, Hanukkah is also not an 8-day event. Hanukkah is a 30-year war. 30 years of wars. But let's pin it at 186, just to give it a time frame. So Hanukkah is 186 BCE, and the Churban Beis HaMikdash is 70 AD, 70-72. So you're dealing with 200, 250 years, rounded out to be 200 years, just to make it. Those 200 years are 200 of the darkest and most pathetic years in Jewish history. Remember I told you sometimes if I got a time machine, which time I'd like to go back to? I'm not going back to that period. No, you're not putting me into that period. Maybe I could to save the day because they needed saviors. It was hard. Constant civil war. Constant splintering of society. And by the way, when I say splintering of society, I mean splintering of society, but not the way you think. Where conservative and reformed Jews splinter society by walking away. These were people who weren't walking away. If you met a Stuki in the street, you know what that Stuki would tell you? And they're pretty powerful and pretty influential. You know what they tell you? You're not firm. I'm a Stuki. I'm a lot firmer than you. For example, oh yeah, you heat up your food on Shabbos, Erev Shabbos, and you enjoy Shabbos morning because you put it in the oven. We keep the real Shabbos. We eat cold food without light, without having fire on Shabbos. And a million other kulos that your Rabbanon allow you because they make these crazy speculative drushos that they say came from Har Sinai. Look what the text says. Text says you count Svira on Sunday. Mimachras HaShabbos, Tisbru Chamishim Yom. You start on Sunday. What's this? Shabbos really means Pesach business. So it's not like they were saying, oh, you know, we're not so interested in being frum because you know, we want to integrate into the modern world to be good Germans. These were Jews who were saying, you're not frum. That's a harder thing to handle. It's always easier to defend your religiosity against those who are walking away because these are your standards. As opposed to, maybe they're right. Maybe I should be going to the mikveh 5 times a day rather than maybe once a month because Sukkot mikveh is all around, all over the place. It's terrible, terrible internal strife. We're always under foreign bondage to some foreign Greek, I don't know, prince or Roman. We didn't really have sovereignty. The Tzedukim infiltrated almost every office. Could you imagine? Think about, okay, how you end Yom Kippur. Just take a moment and put yourself back 7 months ago to where you were at the end of Yom Kippur. How amazing it was. How uplifting it was. What your mind space was. Could you imagine every Yom Kippur going to a Leviah? Because most of the Kohanim Gedolim were Tzedukim. And one of the big, big bones of contention was how you should operate in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. To make matters brief, the Tzedukim would pour the spices
on the coals outside in the Heichal and walk in with the smoke, because that's what it says. Ki be'anan erei ala kaparis, last week's parasha. We have a drasha that says, no, you walk in with the coals and the ktaras, and in the Kodesh HaKadosh, you put the, not you, the Kohen Gadol, puts the ktaras on the coals, and the plume of smoke rises up. Now, if you're standing in the Kodesh HaKadosh and you get it wrong, you die. There's no wiggle room here. So I go, try again. If you're standing in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, so every year, first of all, that's how obstinate these people were. You just saw your associate die last year, but we're right. Last year was probably, you know, just a fluke.
Job.
What?
So the job description would just be who...
No, the Tzedukim controlled the office. It was
right,
a political appointment.
After 15 years, who's signing up for the job next?
People who are obstinate enough to believe they're not going to die because they're right. You'd be surprised how wooden-headed people sometimes are. Always good not to be wooden-headed, okay? Open your mind and read the tea leaves, okay? Don't get caught in your own preconceptions. You'll do a lot of stupid things. Read the room. Read the temperature of the room. People are dying. No, but I'm right. Won't be the first person to say that, right? Okay. So it was a horrible, horrible period. And you know what? Here's another myth I'm going to debunk. The myth is that the Romans captured Yerushalayim. That is totally, totally wrong. The Romans walked into a city of corpses. Because there was so much fragmentation and so much violence, so much animosity amongst the different factions of Jews. They were killing each other, but you know, not that many, because at a certain point, cooler heads prevailed. But they were burning each other's wheat silos. They could have outlasted a Roman siege for about 5-6 years. And you know what? A lot can happen in 5 or 6 years. You got to get called away to France because there's a rebellion in France, the Roman army. You don't know. When you're under siege, you play for time. Let's hold out. Let's get some wheat. Let's bunker down. We'll save our water. Maybe the Romans will have some plague or something. But they literally burnt each other's food silos. They shot each other in the leg. So slowly but surely, people died. Slowly, I hate using this word because I told you last week not to use the word, but in this context you can. Yerushalayim became one big ghetto. And they walked into corpses and skeletons. Of course, they conquered Yerushalayim. But you know what? It wasn't a big military victory. It didn't take a lot. Because everyone was dying and sick and starving to death. If they weren't already dead or demoralized by the civil wars. So this is a horrible period. And, get ready, you may not know where I'm going on this one, but trust me, the leadership wasn't exactly spectacular. The Gemara says that if someone comes to Beis Din and says, hello, my name is whatever, Yehuda, and I come from the Maccabee dynasty, the Hashmonaim dynasty, you know what we tell that person? The Gemara in Kiddushin, you are a slave, and you can't marry a Jew. Or if you are a woman, you are a slave, a servant, you can't marry a Jew. Why? Because everyone knew that within 3 or 4 generations, the entire Hashmonai dynasty was massacred and annihilated. And the only people to escape the massacre were a few stable hands and cooks and slaves. And so if you're saying you're probably one of those slaves, because none of the pedigreed members survived. What was their historic crime for which they were punished? Anyone know the Ramban in Parshas Vayechi? What was their historic crime? The Kohanim, they were Hashmonai ben Aaron Kohanim, they usurped the throne from Shevet Yehuda. They took the throne. And Ramban says this was their sin and for this they were punished. So you're not dealing with squeaky clean leaders. And on top of that, adding insult to injury, two of the leading Tzedukim rebels, we call them rebels, they weren't seen as rebels, came from the Hashmonaim. Have you heard of Janius? Wiki Janius. His name was Yochanan Kohen Gadol, who was a tzaddik, not a tzduki. Until 80 years old, he became a tzduki. I'm sorry. Not Janius, that was his son, John Hyrcanus, Yochanan Kohen Gadol. And he flipped. At the age of 8, he became a punchline. Chazal say, don't trust your religious integrity till the day you die. Always worry that you may flip out and lose it. Because look at Yochanan Kohen Gadol, who was a good guy, till he wasn't. He became a punchline.
Oh, you'll be like Yochanan Kohen Gadol. But not a funny punchline, a sad punchline, and an ominous punchline. And his son was Yanai HaMelech, Janius. Janius, by some estimates, killed 60,000 people in the civil wars. That's pretty bad territory. Not a couple here, a couple there. And these were people that came from the Hashmonai. So I'm not trying to douse your excitement about Hanukkah. I'm trying to pose a question. Just like last week, Yechezkel posed a question. And you don't pose questions, you don't get truths. You just get parrot cliches. So what are we celebrating on Hanukkah? 200 years of destitute tragedy. Terrible leaders. What are we celebrating with Hanukkah? And don't tell me some miracle of oil, which of course has its entirely different conversation, but the Rambam doesn't mention it in the first halacha. So it's obviously, there's a standalone meeting to Hanukkah before we get oily, before we get into the oil. What are we celebrating? Now let's read the Rambam and you'll see the answer. Line number 4. Part 3. Chazra, Malchus, Li Yisrael, Yeser al Masayim Shana ad HaKhorban HaSheni. Everyone listen really carefully to what I'm about to say. It's really important. When Jews achieve sovereignty and self-government, self-determination, we celebrate. And in the case of Hanukkah, we say halal 8 days with a bracha, regardless of its quality and independent of its leadership. How elusive has Jewish sovereignty been throughout our history? If our history is roughly 3,300 years from Har Sinai, let's say, if you want to add Avram Avinu, 3,700 years. We've had sovereignty for about 12. Approximately a third. And when we didn't enjoy sovereignty, the wheels came off pretty quickly. And Hanukkah was Hashem's chance to give us sovereignty one last shot, Raya, before we would lose it for 2,000 years. It was like one last installment of what sovereignty is. You guys, girls have time for a story? You got to run out. Okay. Here's the story. My grandfather, who really changed history, okay? How do you change history? Not by being loudmouthed, raising flags, and capturing headlines. You change history by taking quiet, morally courageous acts that no one knows until 100 years later, you see the outcome. So your biggest heroism in life is going to be the quiet acts that no one knows are heroic, but you'll see one day will make a big difference. So my grandfather decided to leave, and I'll tell you the reason he left. White Russia in the early 20s or something, penniless, came to the United States by himself, collected his pennies, and the story of many, many people. It's not just my grandfather. I happen to know through my personal lens. He brought over family member after family member after family member, kept Shabbos in a period in which Shemir Shabbos was almost nil, almost completely absent, deficient. And he happened to have a lot of brothers, so a lot of people with the last name Tarragon. Today, I don't know how many there are, but hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people with the last name Tarragon. We're all one family. As far as I know, everyone is Orthodox. And they're all because of him. Now, if you were back in 1922, I don't know exactly when he came, and you were reading the headlines of the, I don't know, the Frontonian Gazette, it's not going to say Oscar David Tarragon immigrates to America. Probably had some other headline about some president that no one talks about anymore, and some politics and some government thing to grab the headlines. But you know, it's 100 years later, and his decision was a lot more historically impactful than whatever policy someone made that was reversed 4 years later. Don't get caught up in headlines. History, not headlines. They seem to be exciting, the Trumps of the world, the Netanyahu's of the world. There's larger narratives that you're part of. And just because people aren't paying attention, it's not on the 7 o'clock news, doesn't mean they're not changing history. Now, you have to ignore the headlines and the politics, but just don't get caught up. That's not the field in which history is being written. It's not where it's happening. Historical, this, politics comes and goes. Monarchs come and go. All due respect to your joke of a king, And then lines of governments come and go, and they all come and go. Moral, religious decisions last. These are eternal. These are durable. They're built to last. So why did he leave? What did he tell me was the final straw on the camel's back? He told me that he was once returning home from shul, Shabbos morning, in White Russia, which is where so many Jews lived, the old pale settlement where the Jews were allowed to live in the eastern part of Russia, right at the Polish border. And a Russian soldier screamed at him, I think it was probably World War I, I never asked him, said, Jew, come here. So my grandfather ran. Remember, there were terrible pogroms in Russia throughout the late 19th century, early 20th century. This wasn't a pogrom. The Russian soldier said, you have 20 minutes to go home, collect your belongings, and I'm requisitioning you into the Russian army to be my weapons bearer. No Holocausty, no genocide, but, you know, Jews, fair game. I need a weapons bearer. And he told my Zaidi, he said that if you're not back in 20, 25 minutes, I will hunt you down, and I will kill you and all your family. So I remember asking my Zaidi, like, what did you do? So he took my hand in his hand. And his hands, I remember, were like snakeskin. Why were they like snakeskin? Because after trying his hardest to find a job that would be allowed to be Shomer Shabbos when he made his way to America, and it was almost impossible, a six-day work week, the only job he could find, again, no one judges people that didn't, but 90% of the people didn't keep Shabbos. He couldn't find a job. My Zaidi said, I just want to keep Shabbos. So he became a chicken shechter, a shechter chickens, a shechid. So he's just running around in the winter, in the morning, chasing chickens, having blood all over his hands. Good luck with your dermatological hygiene, right? You know what happens if you have blood and it's freezing cold and your hands get all rough. And I remember holding my hand, it was like I was holding a leather snake. You rub a stone on it. He said, he took my hand and he said, what could I do? I ran home, got my belongings, and ran back because one of my parents had been butchered. Never met, his parents actually moved with him. I met his father, who still lived, my great-grandfather was still alive. Again today, Baruch Hashem, you'll probably meet your great-grandparents, but in my day, like, most of my friends didn't have grandparents. They were killed in the Holocaust. Well, they barely survived. So like, you have a great-grandfather who's like, are special. You know, most of you either have or you will have, because Baruch Hashem, times have changed and we're living longer and medical advances and security. So I remember meeting my great-grandfather, whom my grandfather brought over. I was always traumatized by that story. And I finally got over my trauma when I made Aliyah. This is my story. I was driving home one Hanukkah night. It was pouring rain, as it sometimes does during Hanukkah in Israel. And driving through Beit Lechem, because there wasn't a bypass road yet, so we used to drive literally through Beit Lechem, past the refugee camp. I mean, when I first came to Israel in 1983, we'd go shopping in Beit Lechem. You just walked around. People didn't attack you. A little different in the 90s, but you're driving through Beit Lechem, and all of a sudden I see a police car in my rearview mirror, see the sirens, see the lights go on, hear the sirens, I pull over, and a policewoman gets out and says, you know you were speeding. I didn't know. She starts writing a ticket. I literally burst into tears. Not tears of sadness. Ticket I'll deal with. I said, my Zaidi lived in abject fear of drunk Russian soldiers. And here I am, in my country, receiving a traffic ticket from a Jewish policewoman during Hanukkah, when we celebrate sovereignty, and she and I are both on our way home to light candles. Then what is chus? What a turnaround in history. I'm not going to rot in some Russian jail for a few weeks until someone looks in on me, or I'm not going to be sodomized by some local drunk thug who just used me as a punching bag. Or with my police force, my country, my sovereignty, I'll never forget that moment. My kids laugh at me because every time I drive by that back road where there's a checkpoint, you know, going down to Beit Shemesh, I always burst out in tears. Why? Because 90% of the people at that checkpoint, and I'm not saying this racist. Maybe I told you this. I'm not saying this racist. They're all Ethiopian women. And they're so cute, and they're such cute smiles. These little girls, these teenage girls. And I tell myself, every time I go past, I say, in every single country in the world, black women are at the bottom end of the food chain. Like, there's nothing worse than being a... Not inherently, but unfortunately, society discriminates against them. single-family parents, underprivileged economically. And here in the country, they're ordering me. They're barking orders at me. Open your trunk and let's see inside. So, what a country to live in. What a country that people that across the world are the most socioeconomic underprivileged people, in this country, we empower them to, you know, be in charge, right? If you went up to the north now, and you, like I always joke with people, Israel's secret weapon is probably like about 3,000 type A, goody-goody, Dati-Lumi girls who are winning the war for us. Why? Because they're sitting in some bunker looking at a computer screen all day, checking whether this Arab terrorist is coughing, sneezing, or going to the supermarket, because girls have better attention span than boys. It's documented. So our intelligence is being driven by like 3,000 girls like you. Maybe they're not learning, maybe they're not religious, but they're sitting there, and they're surveilling, and they're hearing, and they're listening, and they're, you know, we'll see you next year. They're winning the war for us. It's not like we have such G.I. Joe soldiers. Like 3,000 Dati-Lumi girls sitting up in some bunker somewhere, looking at the computer, surveilling all these Arab terrorists and all these crazy leaders across the world. Remember about 10, 15 years ago, we went to Nahariya. Took the family to Nahariya for a day. We're walking on the beach, and all of a sudden, like, where's my phone? Can't find it. Fell into the sand. We're all start digging into the sand. Good luck with that. Phone's gone. Kapara, move on. You know, frustrating, but happens. About an hour later, my wife gets a call on her phone. Who is it? The police. Someone handed in your phone, my phone, the number of my wife. They called and come back and retrieve your phone. Man, I walked to this police station in Nahariya. I was crying. It was the first time I've been in a police station since I met Ali. I'm not a drug lord. I don't hang out at police stations. This is the first time I was in a police station. I started hugging police officers, crying, telling stories about my grandfather. These people were like, get this crazy lunatic out of our station. Just take your phone and get the heck out of our... But are you kidding? A Jewish police officer, a Jewish soldier? You know what your parents would say? What your grandparents would say? They saw that? You know, the fear and terror people sense when soldiers came to town? Excuse me for saying it. You know, fear you felt as a female? Because these were men who were away from their families, away from home, impunity. Whatever they wanted. Now, Jewish soldier, that's why it's so important never to disrespect symbols of government. Whether I think Netanyahu is an idiot or a hero, he represents something larger than himself. Whether I feel the policeman or policewoman is enforcing a policy that I agree with or disagree, I can protest, but I'm never going to disrespect the badge or the symbol. Because they are the representation of something larger. And the second that you disrespect them, you're slowly dismissing the symbol and what it represents. And without the larger symbol, you're cooked. So we got through one source today. I'm proud of myself. Next week, we'll talk a little bit about Yom Yerushalayim. Okay? Intellectual honesty, girls. Okay? Work it through. Work it through. Don't be a parrot.
You realize you disrespected the king on the eve.